Welcome to you all, and before I begin, I just have to say congratulations, Martin, and to the rest of the crew. This is just a terrific film, and we're all still in the glow, and we'll dig into the specifics of it, but I want to start by just saying congratulations.
All right.
Really was terrific.
Thank you.
My name is Eric Owens, and I'm the interim director of the Boise Center for Religion and American Public Life, and I teach in theology here. You're in for a treat because we have some really special and extraordinarily smart people on our panel to talk about our subject today. Our panel tonight is also co-sponsored by the History Department and the Theology Department. Several of the folks up here have received their PhDs from those programs, others teach in them, and so we really appreciate the departmental support as well. Let me just say that the general format of our conversation will be to talk a few minutes about the making of the film, and then we'll talk about the Reinhold Niebuhr depicted in the film, and then the Reinhold Niebuhr for us today, or not. And of course, we'll have lots of time for conversation with you. Many of you have studied Niebuhr, have written on Niebuhr yourselves, and we're going to have lots of time for conversation as well. In the interest of time, and because we have a large panel, I'll be very short with my introductions, I'll mention Martin. I'll introduce you along the row here, and then we'll get started. Martin Doblemeyer studied religious studies as well as communications at BU, secondarily, right? And has produced since 1984 over 30 films focused on religion, faith, and spirituality. He combines a lifelong interest in religion with a passion for storytelling, and this has brought him to interview people around the world and some amazing personalities as well. You saw today what the fruits of that labor is, so welcome, Martin. Next is Jeremy Sabella. Jeremy holds a PhD in theology from Boston College. He graduated a few years ago and has taught courses in theology, ethics, and American religious history at Yale Divinity School, Fairfield University, and Kalamazoo College. His dissertation was on the politics of original sin around the concept of original sin in U.S. foreign policy. So this is your bailiwick, exactly. And he's the author of the companion book to the film that you saw that will be coming out in April. Is that right?
That's right.
Sometime soon from Erdman. So keep your eyes peeled for that as well. Father Mark Massa, S.J., many of you, all of you probably know, Dean of the School of Theology and Ministry here at Boston College. He's on research leave this year, writing furiously before he becomes my boss at the Boise Center this coming summer. So welcome, Mark. Andrew Finstuen had my job before I did, so we're all connected here in a tight circle. Andrew has gone on to do bigger and better things since he left the Boise Center. And is now at the Boise, not Boise, but Boise State University, out in God's country there, and is the author of a book entitled Original Sin and Everyday Protestants, the Theology of Reinhold Niebuhr, Billy Graham, and Paul Tillich in an Age of Anxiety. And Jeremy and Andrew were both in the production side of the making of this film. And Lisa Cahill, most of you know already, is the J. Donald Monin Professor of Theology here at Boston College. Well-known and well-loved in our faculty, and admirer of Niebuhr as well. Thank you all for being a part. Let me start by asking those of you who are involved in the making of this film, and we'll start with Martin. What were the particular challenges of making this film about Reinhold Niebuhr relative to all the many other films that you've made?
Well, I've been reading Niebuhr for many years, and like you said, Eric, I've done 30 films on religion. So I have to say that once you begin to make a decision that you're going to do this kind of a story, I became overwhelmed with the material, the volume of the material, the opus of his work, and that's daunting to begin with. And then the different directions that the film can go into. And then third of all, the limited resources for visuals. So there is so much written about Niebuhr, that was not going to be the issue, but how can you, even his daughter, said to me at one time, well, how the heck are you going to make a film out of my father? Because there's just not that much material out there to do it. But we were able to mine everything that we could over the whole staff, people working on this, and hopefully we got enough to be able to get it going. First of all, I want to say thanks to everybody coming out on a Wednesday night to see. There was questions about whether or not there'd be any interest on this campus and a dead Protestant theologian. And you folks showed up. We did it last night. We're doing 30 events around, about 25 or 30 events around the country. And last night was Union Theological Seminary. We kicked it off last night, and we had a great house. And I was wondering how many people would show up this evening. I'm thrilled that you all want to come out and see the film and have this kind of conversation. So I think it speaks a lot to what's going on here at Boston College.
Yeah, thank you. Andrew and Jeremy, what was your goal in your depiction of the Reinhold Niebuhr that ended up in this film? What were you trying to project for viewers and listeners?
Well, first of all, it's a thing that somebody who wrote a dissertation on Niebuhr got sort of embedded in how he brought the concept of the original sin to bear on political problems the U.S. faced, particularly in the sort of World War II and early post-war period. I came away with the sense this guy is stunningly relevant. Has things that really help us make theological sense of our place in the world, and can help sort of inject theological nuance and sophistication in the conversations that typically do not have them. So it was just this bank of resources for bringing what to my mind really is a robust Christian lens to political issues. So the challenge with the film project is, you know, he wrote voluminously. I think he wrote over 1,200 individual articles. it's crazy. And you know, in fairness, a lot of these are, you know, short op-eds in the back of newspapers, a lot of them uncredited, but it, you know, incredibly prolific, commenting on everything under the sun. So it's a question of what do you curate, right? What do you sort of pick and choose that will resonate in 2016, in 2017, hopefully in 2020 and 2030, you know? Mm-hmm. What are the aspects of his corpus that speak to current events now and will continue speaking to the America's place in the world going forward?
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add first a word of thanks to Jim O'Toole, my advisor who's in the audience, and appreciate him going back from the time I started here, and also the mention of the Boston Center, which has been incredibly important to me. I came in under Alan Wolf, and I think that's part of why I'm interested in translating this kind of material into the public with that tutelage that I received under Alan and the Blasi Center. So just a great appreciation and thanks for Boston College and the Blasi Center specifically. I'll be brief. I agree with both what Martin and Jeremy said, but I think for me it was also theology in action. Niebuhr deals with perennial themes, basic questions, human nature, social justice, these kinds of things, and those conversations aren't going away anytime soon, to be sure, although changing, for sure. Just so that compelling thought, and he brings a level of humility. He's an academic, although he doesn't have a PhD, he brings a level of humility to his work and how it challenges, I think, each and every one of us. So for me, it was those kinds of things I was interested in bringing this to translate to a wider public, because I think his voice is so important. Not the only important voice of the 20th century. And that's the other piece, is you can tell the history of the 20th century in a sense through his life. It's counter-narrative to a lot of what we understand about the 20th century in terms of the black migration, counter-narrative to some ideas, industrialization, and then into the two world wars, the Cold War. Niebuhr's there at every step of the way, civil rights, and so it's another lens on how to think about the 20th century.
So for Mark and Lisa, all of you are scholars, I'm gonna say producers and scholars for a second to say insider, outsider, in a sense of this. For Mark and Lisa, what are the challenges being someone who knows the theological work of Niebuhr so well in speaking to, you're speaking through the film to a general audience there? What are some of the challenges? How do you face that question, knowing the intricate details, and then speaking to a broader audience about someone like Niebuhr?
The day after the presidential election, my friend Massimo Bajoli called me up, as depressed as I was, and he said, what do you think is the answer to this? I said, well, I think the Lilly Endowment should give me $1 billion, and I'm gonna buy 256 million copies of Moral Man and Woman. Every man, woman, child, and it'll be required to take a test on it before you can buy anything at a grocery store. Two questions that you asked me during the interview that didn't make it, because I know there are a lot of things about things. First, in terms of American politics, as a lifelong Democrat, I have to say, I found the Democrats to be, during this election cycle, incredibly naive. and I found them to be naive in a Borean kind of way. In other words, naive in precisely the way that Ronald Lieber critiqued. Politics is about coercion and power. And theology is about coercion and power. Religious people don't like to hear that, and I know one of the wonderful students here, when you say that's an SDM student thing, I'm like, what? Coercion? Like, you know, is that what it's about? I do think the Christian life, in terms of social ethics, is about coercion. I think the Republicans had a much better narrative on coercion and about American power than the Democrats did. And to that extent, I would say the Democrats, and Hillary Clinton in particular, was incredibly naive in this election. And I think she should have read Ronald Lieber a little more carefully than maybe applied it. And secondly, I think, and I write about this at the end of one of my books, I think Catholics, American Catholics especially, need Niebuhr, because American Catholics tend to be overly trustful of institutions, and especially the institutional church. And I think Reinhold Niebuhr wrote brilliantly and insightfully about why, especially for Catholics who believe in a church that's, on one level at least, infallible and hierarchical, that American Catholics need to recognize what Niebuhr said about the dangers of institutional power, and especially of institutional religion. So I think for that test that I would expect everyone to make, I would be especially hard in grading American Catholics.
Lisa, when you think about speaking to a broader audience about someone like Niebuhr, how does that process work for you?
I mean, first of all, I think the film shows that there isn't any problem in trying to communicate Niebuhr's essential vision to a broader audience, because it resonates so well with the realities that we see around. This came from the film. I think it was someone reading a quotation from Niebuhr, but it mentioned nationalistic rhetoric instead of government, and racial division instead of, I don't know, something else. And we can certainly look around and see how that plays today. I think just to bring in maybe two dimensions, one positive and then more critical, that didn't come out in the film. So one is to specifically look at the Catholic approach to social ethics and social change, which a lot of people here might be studying. And if we look at Catholic social teaching, so the target there, for instance, as expressed by Cornel West, was liberal Protestantism and the social gospel and its optimistic view of history. The Catholic tradition and the social encyclicals in the modern period, especially after Vatican II, appeal John the 23rd to all men of goodwill, or Pope Francis reaching out to all Christians and all believers in God. So there's a positive, hopeful energy for change that's a plus, but we sometimes forget the truths that Reinhold Niebuhr articulated so well, which is, hold on, it's not that easy. Not everyone is of goodwill, and all of us are of self-interested bad will, at least some proportion of the time. So I think that's very necessary. I think, however, there's also a criticism that can come out of this, that So the position of Niebuhr is Augustinian. So Cornel West said that, and then Robin Lovin, another scholar of Niebuhr, also said the same thing. So Augustine had a very strong view of the power of sin in human history, shared by Niebuhr. Niebuhr's great insight is collective egotism. So individuals subsume their self-interest in the transcendent value of the collective, which is exactly what we've seen in national politics. But the problem is that that speaks well to a country like the United States when it's focused on American exceptionalism. That's Andrew Bacevich's point and why he likes Niebuhr. But what it doesn't capture so well is where movements come from that as collectives and not just as individuals resist that. So you saw a big role of the civil rights movement, and Niebuhr was useful because he helped King and others identify the power of structural evil. But the theology doesn't really account for the power of the movement itself as religiously empowered and as a collective movement. So, for example, some feminist theologians criticize Niebuhr for identifying pride as the sin, but they're saying, what about people that don't have enough sense of self? How do we empower the oppressed, you know, or how do the oppressed claim their own voice? So I think that's kind of a dimension that we also need. I think that's why Bernie Sanders and even Trump, you know, appeal to a lot of people.
So there's one that's a bunch of really terrific things to latch onto here. Can we linger on the question of structural sin for a second, and how whether or not there were some commentary in the film around Gary Dorian, I think, was critiquing Niebuhr's vision of social sin there. Did any of you want to speak on that for a moment, around what the strengths and weaknesses are, building on Lisa's point about resources for resistance, but also insights or not into structural, institutional sources of these sin, not just human nature, but large scale?
Well, I'll jump in briefly, picking up on Dr. Cahill's point, and borrowing from Robin Lovin, I'll just borrow from. Picking up on Dr. Cahill's point and borrowing from Robin Lovin is that Niebuhr's a counterpuncher in terms of not actually maybe enough to initiate. And so I think that's an important point, and appreciate you bringing it up, and I think Robin characterized it in that way. On the other hand, I think there is mobilization, and I actually disagree with Dr. Dorian to the extent to which he makes the argument that Niebuhr's not aware of the structures of sin, or even the structures of racism within our society. In fact, that's precisely why he pushes Billy Graham to focus more on, through a series of articles in the 1950s, to focus more on, he wants Graham to move away from pietistic individualism and understand the way in which social sin operates. So I think, yes, there's complexity there. Yes, he may not do enough to initiate movements. But I think it's a little too easy to say he's not paying attention to structures of sin, and I'll leave it to others to comment too.
I think one of the great strengths of Niebuhr's work, from early works like Fleas and the Pages of a Tame Cynic all the way to the end, is that he recognizes in the tropes of Christian theology powerful symbols that address deep human reality. So the tropes of sin and redemption, Adam and Eve, Christ and redemption, in the resurrection, the need to overcome both personal sin and also address social sin. I think for a lot of people today, including, I think, religious Americans, those tropes, I think, don't mean as much. Yeah. And therefore, I think people both on the right and the left believe that social change is going to happen easily. And all you have to do is convince people of the rightness of your cause. And the barriers will simply collapse, and you're just going to walk right into righteousness. And Niebuhr says, no, Christians have this old and quite powerful sense of original sin, this original disorderedness in all of us, even in the best of us, you know, we have this. And that has to be met and challenged, and there has to be, this comes under his category of coercion, this has to be challenged and actually worked out, sometimes violently worked out. With social change, I think that's the brilliance of Martin Luther King. But he saw, well, of course we're going to use nonviolence, we're going to use Gandhian ways of addressing the social sin of racism in the South, but it's going to cost a lot to do that. The cost is going to be high, and there are going to be many martyrs for the cause to change. And it's not going to be easy.
Yeah, you know, this is a simple point, but it's one that I think we need to be reminded of perpetually. And that's the fact that, first of all, we're all implicated in evil structures, period. And we have a certain responsibility as people of faith to figure out how to extricate ourselves from those structures as best we can. And the second point, which is very much connected to that, is that people of goodwill are implicated in those structures, right? When you look at the sort of great tragedies of history, I would think Niebuhr would be the first to say, listen, you know, millions upon millions of people don't become monsters. They're good people that are seduced by structures of evil. And you and I are vulnerable to that exact same type of seduction. And I think, you know, particularly in this sort of time of fractured, fraught discourse in American politics, I think Niebuhr provides us resources for having conversations with the other side with integrity, right? To be able to sort of state our points clearly, state the moral stakes that we see in current circumstances clearly, but still hold on to the recognition of the fact that the person on the other side of the aisle, there's still a lot of fundamental goodness in them. And that, yes, we may believe that they are implicated in structures of evil, but whenever we say that, we have to be reflective about the fact that, you know what, in ways that you and I may not understand sorely. And so it provides a basis of conversation where you can sort of hold on to the tension of trying to remove the speck in your brother's eye while still being aware that you have planks in your own.
I think that the irony for me, if I can borrow a phrase from Niebuhr, is the notion that even that you're in tension with the person on the other side, more often than not, the person is, the foundation for that person's principles comes out of the same text as your own. They're reading the same Bible. They have the same kind of hope for America. They have the same, they've interpreted the vision of the founding of this country differently, but it's coming out of the same basic text. And that, for me, is the most challenging thing. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge going forward in the next few years, is the recognition that they're not the other, they're actually coming out of the same principles, but they see those principles in a different way.
One question for, you're all historians of a certain sort, and some of you specifically, as a discipline of history, have we as Americans lost something essential in the past 50 years that Niebuhr and his ilk knew? Have we lost a sense of America, a sense of tragedy, a sense of sin? Or is there something that's really different in our culture today? Or are these things still latent in ways that can be reclaimed? That's a big one, but it'll lead us into the Niebuhr today question, I think.
Well, I think Father Mazza, the vocabulary question, how does sin, I mean, sin has these connotations, or written sin, these connotations that almost you can't get past, and Niebuhr didn't mean it in the ways in which we often interpret it, and that's why I appreciate the use of symbol, you know, symbol original sin, or how Niebuhr talked about it. He believed in it. He thought it was an accurate representation of history, both in terms of individuals and the world, and his argument, which is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, is say, prove it to me otherwise. In other words, look at the rest, the history of humanity, both individually and collectively, and now argue for me that this is somehow progressive and we are good. And I will show you a way in which history proves otherwise. But the vocabulary is missing, the sort of structures of common language, which I'm not necessarily saying you don't want to necessarily go back to the 50s and a kind of consensus culture that had ways in which language was repressive. So, but that's a real challenge. What sort of tradition of thought do we draw on as younger and younger generations come up and really don't have, and I don't mean this, maybe not in this context, but in my public university, for example, are religiously illiterate. So they don't, even if they want to reject it, they don't know what they're rejecting, they don't know what terms they're rejecting, and the right students. So I think that's one of the challenges.
I would say three things. My very smart colleague at BU, Steve Prothero, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Religious Literacy in America. It's a great book. It's full of powers, but it's a great book. And he and I have been talking when he was working that book, and I told him about a syllabus I've handed out to upper level undergraduates a number of years, of smart undergraduates, that will list all the, and on it on the front was a list of all the texts we'd be reading. And afterwards, a student came up to me after class, he said, Dr. Massa, where's the book of Job? And I thought, this will be a long semester. Yeah. I mean, they don't even know the most basic texts. Whether they're religious or not, I mean, Harvard used to require, for all English majors, a course called The Bible is Literature. Because you can't read Shakespeare or Milton or any of those people without really understanding what the Bible is about. And I think we as a culture have just lost that literacy, that resonance that I think sacred texts had in the past. Secondly, I think we've lost a sense of the tragedy of life because of our culture of therapeutics. You know, be all you can be. You can be whatever you want. And I'm always telling my students, actually, you can't. That's not true. You can't be whoever you want. But there's a sense of tragedy in life that we're bounded, that we're spirits with bodies, and we're bounded by facticity, by historical realities. And that's tragic. There's a tragedy, not tragedy in the sense of a sad ending, but tragedy in the sense that we're bounded by things we don't have control over. And I think that's just culture-wide, I believe. And finally, I think I think Niebuhr's single smartest book was called The Irony of American History. And by irony, he meant that actions undertaken for God in history always end badly. You know. Or as Tony Blair said at one time, let's not bring God into it, it makes things worse. And Tony Blair was a believer, a devout believer, actually. Well, that he didn't mean that God was irrelevant, but rather we're all too easy to sort of bring in God to justify, to baptize our causes, just as our opponents or whatever they are bring in God to baptize their causes, without recognizing that the very use of that kind of language to talk about political, social, or economic campaigns is always ironic. God's purposes are not our purposes, and that's what makes God God.
So, was part of your question, do you think Americans today have lost the sense of social sin or evil?
Yeah, I think part of my question is, what distinguishes us from Niebuhr's era in the way that we understand his message?
Right.
And certainly the religious literacy and the theological conviction, the sense of being convicted by that, things have changed, but what else?
Well, the one thing I just wanted to put in there is that, you know, Niebuhr and Niebuhr's insights, I still find really brilliant, and I use Niebuhr a lot, so I don't want to see myself in harping on the downsides, but it works really well for a certain social situation and mentality. So after World War I, but especially when he wrote The Gift of Love, or delivered The Gifford Lectures, as World War II was beginning, and especially right after World War II, there was really a sense of America's exceptional leadership in the world and moral rectitude and how we were going to, you know, set the path, etc. So I think in the face of that, what he says is key and important and essential. And to the degree that, again, we think America's the greatest, we don't need the immigrants, you know, then that we still need to hear that. But something that I see in today's United States is different from the 40s to the 60s is really not skepticism that institutions are corrupt, but an acceptance and apathy in the face of corrupt institutions. Like, you know, I've given up on politics. Like, young people don't vote in many cases. They're detached. They don't feel they can do anything, or we don't feel. So, you know, on some level, we need to re-engage and realize that as deep as corruption is, and yes, the politicians are out to get re-elected at the midterm elections, and they're all in the pockets of the corporations, and, you know, et cetera, Trump just wants to deregulate business and lower taxes. That's corruption, you know, and so people are giving up. And I think we also need some sort of conviction about what is possible. So sometimes religious ideals can inspire positive social action. That's Pope Francis and Laudato Si, or maybe doing a vigil for nonviolence in Syria, which he did at the Vatican. So we need that too, you know, commitment as well as skepticism. So I think in Niebuhr's era, he didn't have to worry about disengagement. That wasn't the social problem in the U.S. at the time. It was overconfidence, unselfcritical, lack of humility, interventionism. Mm-hmm. But that's not where our mindset is today.
I was just going to say that my wife and I, we live in Washington, D.C., and everybody in Washington, D.C. feels as though this is going to be an extraordinary year for protest, demonstration, and public displays of frustration, anger, and discontent with what's happening, which we haven't seen ever. I mean, the day after the election, just by numbers, half the people in this room probably voted for Donald Trump. Just maybe not in this very room, but across America. I'm going to go.
I think that's highly unlikely.
I'm going to leave and do screenings for this film all across the country. I'm going to be very aware that half the people in that audience, that every night after night we'll do this, probably feel as though a good thing has happened here. I have to be very aware of that. But the truth of the matter is, the day after he takes the oath of office, one of the biggest demonstrations in the history of this country happened in Washington, D.C. I thought that says
people were willing. I saw them in the airport showing up. They were embracing. They felt as though they were on to something that was happening. So for me, I think the tide is starting to turn. It's going to be a different America over the next. But foundationally, my hope is that Niebuhr actually is listened to and read. We had an event last night at Union Theological Seminary, and one of the guests, Cornell West, was on his way after our event to be on the Sean Hannity show.
Yes.
Do any of you not know who Sean Hannity is? So I said to him before, I said, well, you have to bring a copy of this Niebuhr film to Sean Hannity. And I think he was on his way to do it. He walked out with a DVD in his hand.
Yeah.
So it's time to sort of draw on different resources, but I think people are activated. What I'm really hopeful is that as they begin to mobilize, come together, coalesce around different themes, that they have a foundation for it. I think Niebuhr can actually offer some kind of sense of a foundation.
Did you see the Sean Hannity film?
I did not.
Okay.
Did you?
No.
Well, one interesting thing about Niebuhr is that although his language of existential humility, our requirements of humility in the face of our limitedness and our rationality that we aren't limited, despite the centrality of humility, he was prone to grand statements and pithy ones at that. Summarizing the world in a sentence or two, right? And we all probably have some of those quotes written down or highlighted somewhere that are really thoughtful. And is that what we need today? Someone who can pull that off, who can speak in what we now call sound bites, or what? Another way of asking the question is, who is our American conscience today?
Well, who's our neighbor? I'll start as... I'm a filmmaker. My first area that I care most about is religion. I use the film making to communicate the religion. So I see myself in the religion world and then communicating. And I'm not a filmmaker first. I don't think of myself as a filmmaker. But for people who will begin to take the stage as public theologians now going forward, they better be able to speak in pithy little sound bites, because that's all they're going to get. I mean, they can go out and read the book afterwards if they want to, but the truth of the matter is we have gotten worse. I mean, Twitter's... we're the Twitter generation. I've been told I don't tweet, and I've been told as we go around the country now that I should be tweeting. Here I am at Boston College. Look at this. But the truth of the matter is, if people will have what they require now, the format is set up, the discussion context is set up, that whoever's going to be able to sort of articulate a vision and a voice and become an American conscience for us and continue to vocalize those ideas has to be able to do it in the formats that are now accepted.
Mm-hmm. So if I can actually, you know, go to your earlier question before going to the later one. I think it's easy for us, for a lot of reasons, to lose sight of how hard won the sense of sin was that Niebuhr and his ilk carried around, right? It took a world war. Before Pearl Harbor, we were an isolationist nation. Before Pearl Harbor, we were too busy squabbling about immigration quotas to accept German Jewish refugees on the St. Louis, right? That was the reality of the before Pearl Harbor. It took a world war to awaken a sense of social sin robust enough where the discourse of somebody like Niebuhr carried weight. On one level, that might sound depressing. On another level, I think what it means is that sense can come back. Let's just hope it doesn't take catastrophe to bring it back. And you know, that's the challenge that, as somebody who works with Niebuhr, that I'm sort of working through. This comes to your second point. How do you sort of jumpstart that sense of sin and grace and how these concepts apply to the broader social sphere without the worst having to happen? Okay. But on the question of, you know, how do we sort of have that voice today? You know, Stanley Hauerwas in his interviews, and you know, very characteristic Stanley Hauerwas fashion, says, you know, I've learned a hell of a lot from Niebuhr about how to turn a provocative sentence. Right, I think actually a Niebuhr Twitter feed would be amazing. I think you really could. Just, there are so many quotes that you could take that they're just so well turned and so pithy, and he's working with this kind of, you know, the lesson there for me, there's all sorts of things about our soundbite culture that are frustrating, but if you've ever heard a really good preacher, this is what they do. They manage to turn a phrase that just blows your mind. So I think there is a way to sort of up our rhetorical game to the point where we are able to compel, even in within the constraints of a soundbite culture.
We're also an image culture, you know, so symbolic actions and images as well as words, I think, are called for. I mean, infinite words are good too. Yes.
Climbing the flagpole in Charleston or in Columbia, yeah. South Carolina, I'm thinking the flag deck, for example, things like images that capture people's attention. Is anyone willing to say who our American Niebuhr is today? Or at the very least, who can we say is the, and then we'll turn it out to the audience to, if you have any thoughts on that, and ask any questions you want. But who represents the kind of moral voice that we're saying Niebuhr was for his time?
Well, if I can give an anecdote from our first screening.
Yep.
Right? So we first screened at the American Academy of Religion. Bunch of people that were in it came out for that screening, including Cornel West, right? So that question was asked. You know, somebody raised the point, we don't have any Niebuhrs anymore. Somebody else in the audience says, oh, but, you know, we have in the room Cornel West, who's this public theologian who sort of takes the role of Niebuhr. As soon as she was done, Cornel West marches right up to the mic and he says, I thank you kindly, ma'am. I am no Reinhold Niebuhr. And another friend of mine who's you know, another professor who works in these Niebuhr circles make the point, and I think this puts the nail on the head. Yeah, Cornel West is performatively one of the closest things we have to Niebuhr, but the sort of cultural stage on which one person can do all that work no longer exists. Mm-hmm. And the point that this person made was, we don't need one Niebuhr, we need 1,000 of them. And I think what I see that as saying is, we need to sort of maybe observe the sort of the theology, right? The sort of the rhetoric, the willingness, the sort of courage to take risks in public and to say things. And we need a lot of people who have the courage to put themselves out on a limb like that.
I would say too that I think in some ways sounds so pedestrian, but I think the media has a lot to do with it. I think you see a lot of Reinhold Niebuhr. He winds up on the cover of Time magazine. There's a whole story back behind that. But the truth of the matter is, I think back in the 1940s and the 1950s, the general media was much more accepting of religion as part of the American culture, and just generally understood that it had its place. And therefore, the people who spoke on behalf of it, whether it's Billy Graham or Reinhold Niebuhr, had their place. And they were given their place. They were given prime time, frankly. That's what happened. I think there's much greater skepticism on the role of the media today overall to give significant airwave time to anybody who speaks on behalf of religion out of the fear that it becomes even more polarizing. I face a lot of that myself, because if I give time to this person, then I have to give time to that person, and I just don't want to get involved in that. I just don't want to get near the religion thing. And frankly, I think a lot of people in the media couldn't give a hoot. They don't see religion really, except in the stories that are religion in the extreme. You know, if I have a snake-handling kind of pastor who gets bit, then that's going to be a story. But the truth of the matter is that most people are not really particularly interested in the media and the stories that are really underlying in religion. It's given us a window to be able to do this. But I think even as people begin to emerge, whether it's Cornel West or Tim Keller in New York and people like that, who are really smart, very articulate, and very thoughtful about their faith, the amount of space they get in the American landscape in the media is very limited.
Well, I think another way of reading that that's somewhat different is that the good thing about social media, as we all know, is that it connects everyone, and everyone is constantly in contact with everyone else. The bad thing, and I'm not obviously not prepared to say this, the bad thing about social media is people live in their own bubbles now. You know, people get all their information about the real world from X, Y, and Z. Their iPhones are set to get, you know, updates from certain websites, and that's their understanding of the world. So we've sort of balkanized the idea of the media as a place that everybody, that one side is a place that everybody goes to. Time magazine, let's say, or even the New York Times would be a place where everybody goes to get their news. So some people watch Fox, and some people watch MSNBC, and some people, you know, have this thing tweeted to them. So I think that the idea that they're under the current situation of the current state of social media, that there could be or several religious individuals who could be prophetic in the way that Niebuhr was, is really challenging. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how that would work, actually. There's all kinds of religious figures who speak, and lots of people listen. Pastor Rick Warren, Brian Hare at Harvard. I mean, there's all kinds of religious people who are very serious prophets, in a sense. But they're
they don't unite anyone. They have their followers, and their followers take their cues from them. I mean, other people would never think of looking at anything they would say.
And what would you also say, too, that because there's so much availability of different kinds of media out there, that people pick those kinds of media, not because they affirm what they already understand and believe, or versus challenge them into new ideas?
Right. That's precisely. The prophetic stance is one that says, I have to challenge someone, not because they're bad, but precisely because they're good. I mean, that was Niebuhr's thing. You know, they're not evil. They're just complicit instructors of evil. But that presupposes that we're both standing on the same platform. I think that platform's gone.
Andrew?
Well, there's a lot running through my head. And I think that one of the warnings that Niebuhr has for us all is, you know, pretend that we can manage history or predict history, which we do a lot of. And I don't think Niebuhr, I'm going to do some of this. I think what a person who died 40-some years ago would have thought. I don't think he'd be that surprised at the rise of Trump and that Trump's elected, because we thought we could manage this process. I really appreciate Dr. Cahill's point about the apathy combined with this exceptionalism that might be breaking out. There might be a moment of breaking out of this apathy. Again, our inability to predict and manage history. So that's part of it, is picking up on the notion of there might be somebody, or it's challenging, but could emerge. But I kind of come back to language, and, you know, in some ways I feel like we're even more euphemistic than ever. And so we'll call things, like, I've been in serious meetings where people are talking about mistakes as cognitive errors, where, you know, things like microaggressions, aren't they just aggressions? So I'm worried about the ways in which we have we're over-specialized in our language, we're over-specialized in our media, and we don't really have a common way of talking about these things. There might not be a way that we can have that, I don't know, but if we can speak in plain language and have plain kinds of sensibilities and not in the dumbing down aspect, that's one point. The other thing is, I do think people are hungry for substance. Hungry! It's just not delivered, and I won't bore you with the details of why I think this, but a number of audiences that I've spoken with, and undergraduates too, who are hungry for this kind of conversation, whether they agree with Niebuhr or not, or where they are in the spectrum of politics or faith. But again, it comes back to, where's the center? We don't have a center, and I'm not, this is where I don't know how to put that back together. In the best sense of that, because we don't want a center of Niebuhr's time. Right. We don't want that center. Including Niebuhr's own sense of the center. Anyway.
I hope you're right, Andrew, that there's a hunger for it, because we'll know whether or not the ratings are no good to this film.
That's our barometer.
That's our barometer right there. That's the big question.
Lisa, any thoughts before we turn that? Okay. So let's take some questions and comments from the audience, and tell us your name, and then go ahead.
Fred Lawrence, Theology Department. Well, I thought the film was stunning. I love the fact that at the very beginning you emphasized his testimony. And the other thing is, he's a mind at work, but he's a mind at work in an overwhelmingly communicative way. And the people who were so who bore witness to him in the film, three of them were Jews. One was Horowitz, who completely disagrees with them, but realizes he's objectively loved. How could you not love him? See? And then to think through things in ways that are controversial. But he thinks for himself. He's not. Just echoing stuff that's around all the time, but he's really working at things. And when that crucial time came, when he had to talk about, face the fact that you might have to use violence, but then later on when he said, well, maybe we shouldn't be going so slow, so fast, I mean, the Burke moment. And yet, all those people thought, this guy is something to look up to, because he has an authenticity that's just unmistakable. And I think that's a tremendous thing that you brought out.
Right.
And I really appreciate it.
Well, it's a huge opus of work that he created. I mean, it's 24 books, 2,500 articles on his own.
plus all the material that's created by other people writing about Reinhold Niebuhr, the material is just overwhelming. But from my challenge was to be able to bring this kind of a story. It's hard, every film I can tell you, it's hard to do a story about a writer. It's just that's a tough challenge. But to be able to, you know, to tell this story, public television is about the only place you're going to get a story told like this, and I'm grateful that there's an opportunity for me to do it. But I had to make it both true to the theology of what I was interested in, but also a human interest story, so that the majority of people I knew would come to this would have no reference for Reinhold Niebuhr whatsoever. And that's kind of became my starting place.
Let's take more questions. Yes?
Hi, I'm MJ Farrelly. I had Mark Massa as a student. As an undergraduate many years ago. But Martin, I have a question for you. I wanted you to maybe follow up a little bit on something you said very early in the conversation. You had said that you think it's important for us when talking with the other to remember that they're coming at these questions from the same principles. And the follow-up I wanted you to say is why? Why do you say that? And the reason I'm asking is one of the questions I've been grappling with since this election, and it's maybe a very Niebuhrian way of looking at it, is I'm not sure that is the case. You know, that I wonder if we might be seeing a real rupture in our American church. We're a church that was built on a theology that said rights are unalienable, that they are an inherent part of who you are as a human being, and that we might be seeing a new theology emerging here that says, no, rights are something that need to be earned. And then we can have a debate about what rights and behaviors and what behaviors and identities earn those rights and what don't. But I mean, that if that is happening, it seems to me I'm not necessarily dealing with someone who's coming at the issue with the same principles. But tell me I'm wrong, please.
well, for me, My obligation is when I make a film like this is to deliver this to a mainstream audience. And I realize that that's a very different audience than a viewer that's in Cosmopolitan New York and in Alabama. There's going to be a different understanding of it. When I say principles, I believe that the people that I talk to who voted for Donald Trump did so because they felt as though their Christian, a lot of them said that their Christian beliefs made it impossible for them to vote for anybody else. And I would say that my Christian beliefs couldn't possibly have brought me to vote for that same person. So that becomes the starting place for how do I present this film to a national audience. Because I do think, whether you call it principles or those guiding directives for your life that come out of some sacred text that really mean everything to you, that are central in your life, I think they can be interpreted in ways that drive us to do two very different and polarizing things. And I think that's what's happening now.
So basically, we need to be aware of the fact that everybody's coming at the issue in a principled way, though they may not necessarily be the same principles.
I think the people who changed this country on January 20th came out of their understanding of what needed to be done, and many of them did it because they felt as though God was directing them to do it in that particular way. And I think that makes me deal with them and think about who they are in a much different way than if I was to say, they have no clue in the world what they're doing. They have no foundation. They do. They have an idea of who they are and why they're doing this. And I have to respect
that. Lisa, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I have a totally different interpretation of what Niebuhr's saying, which is he's not saying there's goodness in everyone. He's pointing out that there's badness in everyone. That's why his doctrine of sin is so central. And his caution is even we who think we're right, we also share in this collective egotism. And one of his huge points is that collective egotism works best when it harnesses the interests of the people in a group to transcendent values. And in the name of the transcendent, seeks the self-interest of the group, which is not acknowledged in those terms, which is perfectly exemplified by people claiming that their Christian identity justifies what Niebuhr called a nationalistic rhetoric instead of government, and divisive racial politics instead of, you know, the common good. He didn't say the common good, I'm throwing that in there. So it's not that I personally believe that a lot of these people didn't vote with their conscience and they were trying to do the right thing. But I don't think that's what Niebuhr is pointing out. And furthermore, I think what he is pointing out is really worth listening to, because I think there's a heck of a lot of training.
I'd just like to pick up on that. I think he's saying you were sitting all the way to the polls when you voted for Hillary Clinton, and you were sitting all the way to the polls when you were voting for Donald Trump. And that's the platform from which you can actually have a conversation, is the democratization of we are sinners through and through who do not have a wholesome perspective, and yet we pretend that we do. And it's the people who pretend that they do that you have to be most wary of. Now, to your point, Martin, I think that's where he's saying, so you can have a conversation on the basis of that for somebody who thinks differently from you, but if they have that same kind of sense of who they are as a sinner, as not holding the corner on what's virtuous and what's righteous, then we're in play.
Yeah.
So I agree wholeheartedly.
That's the humility theme that you brought up before.
Right.
But there's a moment, you're the person who asked this in the class you were in with me about when we were reading Moral Man and Moral Society. Because it comes off as, you know, Time Magazine's cover story on Niebuhr was called The Good News of Damnation. It is a negative message. So what's the good news here? It was called the gospel, so what's the good news? And you asked that question. And so, you know, I forget the page it was on in Moral Man, but Niebuhr says, the purpose of prophetic witness, and we all swim in the sin of the sea of sin and selfishness and so forth. And you're right, we sin all the way to the earth, no matter which level. But the point of prophetic witness is to create enough space in a person's life that they will be able to discern and choose the good. That's about as good as it gets. That's about as good as the gospel gets. Because finally, the gospel fails as a mass message in terms of having everyone live the grace of social witness to the truths of Christianity. But rather, it's an uphill battle to create that circle of choosing the good. I think that's what he did so well as a prophet, actually, making people aware of that.
Let's get more questions. Here and then Suzanne.
This is just a quick comment.
Try to speak up if you can, please.
This is just a quick comment on the first question. I agree that people voted for Donald Trump for many reasons. And some of them voted out of principle, and some of them are good and decent people. I also think that Hillary got it right when she called many of his core supporters deplorables. So this, you know, it's not like everyone in this world would just disagree on means to an end that we all agree we want. There are some nasty people in the world, and they were some of the people who supported Trump. And that doesn't mean we should demonize Trump voters and look at it in the black and white term.
Okay, thanks.
I'm not a student of Niebuhr, so this is me seeking information. I'm very curious about Niebuhr insofar as, does he have a Christology? Where does his Christology fit into all of this?
If that's his brother.
Well,
H. Richard.
I mean, then maybe that's the answer. But it seems, I mean, in the film it talked about how he doesn't have a view of the church, and then it also talked about his close connection with Heschel, who obviously doesn't have a Christology because he's Jewish. So I'm just, does Niebuhr have a Christology, and where does it fit in?
I think Niebuhr has a, he would hang on the hook of prophet. And that's why it's not surprising at all that he was friends with Heschel.
Okay.
He sees Jesus as the prophet from Nazareth, who could witness to the truth and create that space in people's lives. I think he has a prophetic Christology. I think almost certainly he doesn't have a high Christology. The Catholics would call high Christology a son of God before, you know, of the same substance as the Father. That was just something Niebuhr was not interested in. It was kind of speculation he found, I think, boring, finally, and unhelpful. How would we know? How would we know that?
I mean, in not in Moral Man and Moral Society, but in what is a better thought out book, which is Nature, Destiny, and Man, he does have a Christology. And it's a reformed Christology. He has a lot in there on atonement, and it's really, I would have to say, penal substitution as an atonement. He's very emphatic about the need for grace for salvation, and very dim or skeptical, as was Augustine, about the concrete effects of justification in history. So he's high on justification and low on sanctification. So there's a certain Augustinian reform type of Christology. He has also, again, fitting in with the social ethics, he uses the symbol of the Antichrist. So with every growth of the possibility of good in history, there's an equal growth of evil. So it's like a really different mentality than Catholic social teaching, for example. But he does have a Christology.
Yes.
Hi, Andy Jewett at Harvard. I want to bring another book out, The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness from 1944. This question about some of Trump's supporters, if there's a you know, if there are bad intentions in some of these cases, does that book help us think about how those of us on the side of light might want to deal with that? That book is very much written to say that there are forces of evil in the world, you know, that it's not a sort of even plane, but how do those on the other side both, you know, recognize their own sin, but also deal with the realism of those who are not struggling, you know, and not sort of impeded by their ideals. Is that relevant in this situation?
Well, you know, one of the it's actually one of my favorite Niebuhr books, mm-hmm. because it's the way he uses the trope of light and darkness is really sophisticated. You hear the title, it sounds Manichaean. It sounds like he's going to do this division of the world into the spheres of light and the spheres of darkness, where you can clearly identify those on the side of good, clearly identify those on the side of evil. But then you start cataloging who he identifies as this foolish child of light. And it's everybody, right? Most everybody. So not
Nazis,
everybody.
Though.
Yeah, so there are two people. No, but rank and file Nazis, still foolish children of light. Right? So the two people on my reading that he just says, these are children of darkness, are Napoleon and Hitler, right? And I think, you know, maybe you know, Stalin works his way in there as well. But it's the point here being, you know, he's saying the vast majority of us are foolish children of light. We've been seduced, right, by those that sort of cynically use, who know no law beyond their own self-interest and cynically use the rest of us. So I think there is room for you know, yes, there's room there for saying there is evil, and there are very occasional individuals who are almost, not entirely, but almost purely evil. But the vast majority of us have been seduced by something, and it's the sort of work of Christian witness is working on undoing that seduction.
Now, look at that book. Began as a sermon he gave, mm-hmm. and preached. But it's based upon a very famous image, I believe in the Gospel of Matthew, where Jesus says to his disciples, the children of this world are wiser than the children of light. So it's a prophetic stance addressed specifically to disciples, saying, point in fact, the people who live according to the world's criteria are smarter and savvier than the children of light, than the supposedly saints, than the disciples. And precisely for many reasons, but I think he says in that sermon, that they just think that God's going to take care of all this. That they're going to lay back and somehow God's going to intervene and make all of this right. He said, that's not how it works. That's not what Jesus meant. And that's not how it works.
Yeah, I mean, Niebuhr's worried about idealists more than anything else, right? And so the light and dark is what Niebuhr's, and we've talked about this somewhat, but it's queer always and also light and dark, and you cannot separate those two things. And he talks about in that, you know, his vindication of democracy, and part of the way he defines democracy in that book, another one, is that democracy is about the harmlessness of the dove and the venom of the serpent, or something like that. And what he's trying to get you to think about is that you all of us, myself included, have dove capacity and serpent capacity, and it's all bound up. It's not, you cannot separate it, right? But mostly what we do is we fly to the dove or we fly to the serpent, and those are both untenable positions in history for him. And so that book is incredibly important for both how he, it's sort of like his, you know, his theory of democracy, but it's really just rooted in that sense of human nature, sainted and sinful, always and already. And once, I've got to repeat myself, once you have that disposition, now you might actually be able to do some work. And that's where I draw on Dave Chappelle's book, which is somewhat controversial, but his book on the civil rights, where he's saying that's really what King God, and Father Massa has echoed some of that. That was the baseline, and then to Dr. Cahill's point, then you move beyond that to initiate King. But, and it's also the distinction between hope and optimism. Niebuhr thinks optimists are silly, right? Because they expect things are going to work out. It's about hope, not optimism, not just a dove, not just cynicism.
Which, and hope always has great thoughts.
Yes.
Other questions? Yes.
Hi, I'm Katie from the theology department at UC.
Speak up a little bit, please, for us.
So my question, I'm wondering what Niebuhr would say in terms of theology and suffering. So because he works so closely with the Jewish faith, typically Christians have a harder time. Why would God do this bad thing? Or where is God in this horrible, tragic event? So I'm wondering, you know, did he draw more from Old Testament or other religious texts? And what did he have to say about that?
I think the film, what the film did so brilliantly is the retention of, see, a fairly affluent congregation in Detroit, which is his one extended pastoral experience in the Bethel Church. And I think because of that affluent congregation, I think even though some of them worked in, for General Motors in the Ford plants, they're completely unaware of the suffering of the people down the street, people who lived within a couple of miles of the river. But I think he's somebody who I think did a great job of bringing the plight of the suffering to the privileged. He has this famous sermon that he gave at the Union Theological Chapel where he said that Union Seminary, at that time it was all male, and he told the seminarians that they were supposed to go out in unions, you know, right on the edge of Harlem in New York City. But it's a bastion of privilege and development. Okay? You're supposed to go out and work in Harlem, and pour your lives out, and then you're supposed to come into the chapel and kneel down and say, I am an unworthy servant, I'm simply done my master's bidding, and both of those things are true. So I think he had this ability to hold together the paradox of the Christian witness of suffering, but also bringing the good news to it, knowing that we were part of that. We were part of the reason why those people were suffering. So I think the complicated theology.
Okay, hi.
My name is Jason. I'm from the theology department as well. I guess one question I had was if any of you could elaborate on what he did find in Gandhi, and if you and what was it about the experience of colonialism that informed his Christianity and sort of civic engagement in the U.S.
Well, so he does mention Gandhi in Moral Man and Immoral Society. In glowing terms, he was very impressed with Gandhi's movement. But the really interesting observation he makes on Gandhi is he says, let's not pretend for a second it's not coercive. He managed to coerce in a nonviolent way. But he says very specifically, says, children in Manchester go hungry because of the strikes in India that Gandhi initiated. Does that mean the strikes are wrong? Absolutely not. They're necessary. This is good. Right? This is calling larger structures into account. But his point, once again, was, you know, we have to be honest about the need for coercion and social change. And the legacy of that, you know, it's, I think you can draw a line from that observation to, and I don't want to overstate my case here, but there is something of that in how Martin Luther King understood nonviolent resistance. Because for King, nonviolent resistance worked precisely because it's coercive. Right? Nonviolent resistance, you think about the images of people getting bitten by dogs, going in front of fire hoses. Why would they put themselves in these sorts of situations to begin with? It's because, you know, the images of that might actually coerce change. So that's a connection with Gandhi. But, to be honest, he doesn't pursue the sort of the lessons of colonialism nearly as much as the rest of us wish he did. You know, you see glimmers of that in his early work. And then, for a lot of historical reasons, there's a lot of debate to be had about it, he kind of loses sight of it. So his early work, you will see that his later work, it's not going to be as big of a factor.
And also, he's writing for the prosperous Protestant middle class. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of people left out, but Lisa said women are left out of this. And feminist ethicists have a problem with Niebuhr, because they rarely appear at all. And also colonialism, he addresses in a robust way in things like Moral Man, a work from the 30s. But later on, that whole theme of colonialism and the sin of colonialism starts to disappear in light of the nuclear threat. There are problems with his focus, I would say. You know, he's a man of his time. And,
Yeah, just to connect two questions. So JC on the comment on the theology of suffering. He's mostly known as a social ethicist. So he does have a theological infrastructure, but he's really about social change and justice. So his view of suffering is that it's a result of sin, and that what we're called to do is fight it. So he doesn't have like a theological interpretation that in any way embraces it. He does have a theology of the suffering of Christ and so on, but his energy is around how do you fight injustice that causes suffering, like you were saying, Mark. And Jeremy, you were saying as well. And then Gandhi's nonviolence, as Jeremy was saying, or Martin Luther King's, is a form of resistance to injustice that is morally commendable because it's nonviolent, but it's also effective for those people at that time because it was nonviolent. So it's really the political and social ethics that I think is the context in which to understand how we...
But he does make coercion an acceptable,
yes, he does.
Makes coercion an acceptable term for social ethicists.
He believed in the use of military force, right, for example,
He was critical of someone like Walter Rauschenbusch, who's the great voice of the social gospel, because he believed that Rauschenbusch was, I think, unfairly criticized as being too utopian, and this is all going to happen. All you're going to do is go out and have a march and protest X, and X will disappear. And you said, that's not how it works. It's going to cost a lot to do this.
We've talked mostly about domestic issues today, and I don't think we don't have the time to move into the foreign policy world that Niebuhr inhabited so dramatically during his time. But it does—it did strike me that a phrase that didn't come up in the film and hasn't come up in our conversation is Christian realism, which is sort of a descriptor of all of what he's up to, but in particular around the questions of foreign policy. And as we think around our current president, who is eschewing the realist stance of what the world looks like and what the people on the ground usually are telling him about power politics, and he's eschewing the Christian part for sure. Just as we wrap up here briefly, what do you think the Christian realist vision that Niebuhr provides, what kind of traction can it hold in the Trump era?
Well, I think one of Niebuhr's great insights is something he hammered away at in the 30s, in the lead up to World War II. You're connected to the world whether you want to be or not. And whether you like it or not, what happens 3, 4, 5,000 miles away will come to your doorstep. That's inevitable. And there's no such thing as perfect security. It does not exist. And anybody who claims to be able to secure that for you is lying, period. And I think the way that he articulates those interconnections between human beings, right, the fact that what's happening in Syria will come to our doorstep, whether or not we accept Syrian refugees, is steeped in Christianity.
I think, too, that we use the quote in the film about the notion of that here we are, we have this sense of domestic security while there's such global insecurity. And I think in many ways, what's been presented to us in the last many months is the notion that if we simply lock ourselves away from the rest of the world, lock the rest of the world out and close the door carefully, that's the way to protect everything, as opposed to understanding that that's not going to be the way that it happens. So he is a global thinker in that way. Mostly, I think, at the heart of it is because he understands human nature,
right,
and the way this is going to continue to play out. And so I think us thinking in terms of we have this domestic tranquility while there's so much global tension, I think it's in some ways it's terribly much. And that's the heart of what Niebuhr has to say.
Anyone else?
You use the term Christian realism, so there's like two parts of what you said, that term and then global politics, but I just want to go back to the Christian realism term. The realist part is don't be naive, be aware of structures of injustice and the way we all get caught up and ideals get co-opted for the purposes of collective self-interest. That's the realist part. The Christian part is that's not just accepted as the way politics is, it's judged. It's judged as against you know, the meaning of the universe is against humanity's ultimate destiny, and we're called to do something about it, to resist and change. So that is the note of hope that
Andrew, I think that's something that Andrew Bazemus misses a lot also. In his use of the chastised America, he fails to take Niebuhr's transcendent possibilities as something that we are called to also.
Yeah. Well, and to pick up on that point, and Jeremy, you can correct me on this, but I know a couple of essays, and I think he even has in the Iron American history, where the ultimate goal is love in international relations for the Christian part, right? So Niebuhr, even though he's so concerned about idealism, he still wants to emphasize love. Then he knows, he pulls back and he says the instrument is justice, but the goal better be love. And that has also lost
I think the image is almost love as a carrot at the end of the day.
Well, I think that's,
Then he sort of, that's the thing we're striving for. Probably
we're not going to reach it. We won't get there.
Right.
Except it always has to be there. This is where religion or faith or sacrificial love, however rare it is, it's really the impetus behind mutual love, which is the impetus behind structures of brotherhood and justice. So you always need that seed to lift things up to a higher level. That's the hope.
Yeah, and he has this wonderful phrase. He calls love the impossible possibility. Mm-hmm. Right. That's the Niebuhrian sort of paradox wrapped as tightly as you can get it. You cannot, even if you know you'll never actualize that sacrificial love, you have to strain for it with all your might. And if we don't have it in mind, if we don't push for it, we won't even get justice.
I also think that Christian realism had a huge effect on seminary curricula, and I like to think it had a big effect here at the seminary. He felt that training seminarians and theological students had to be the most realistic discipline of all. Because I think theology is perceived by some people to be an ivory tower. He said, no. You're involved in the very biggest things. It has to be grounded on the most realistic understanding of human nature and what's likely to happen. And prepare people to go out there and work for that change.
Right. Didn't he say that original sin is the only empirically verifiable aspect of human nature? The doctrine of the Christian faith. Yes, not just human nature. Indeed. What a terrific conversation this has been. I want to thank every one of you.